Hi, I'm Tracy.
I'm April.
And this is Killer Spirits.
Welcome to episode 51 today.
We've made it.
It's Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Yay. Actually, you're getting a special treat today, too.
Two episodes.
You're getting a double feature.
Double header.
Double header.
Happy Halloween and also happy anniversary.
Yes. Anniversary for us.
This marks our 1 year.
I know. I'm so excited.
On the airwaves.
On the airwaves.
So
we're still trucking along.
Yeah. So first of all, today I wanted to thank our friends over at Screwball Whiskey.
Oh my God, I love Screwball Whiskey.
They have sent us a few bottles of whiskey to try.
So good.
And we've made some very good drinks today.
Both episodes have Screwball Whiskey in it.
Yes. So just a few things about Screwball Whiskey, some fun facts. Screwball Peanut Butter Whiskey is the original peanut butter flavored whiskey.
Oh yeah.
They thought of it first. It was developed in San Diego and is vegan and gluten-free. It does contain peanuts. So if you're allergic to peanuts, you can't have it.
Yeah, but if you're vegan, you can tear the shit up.
That's right. It was created by husband and wife duo, Stephen Yang and Brittany Merrill Yang, in July of 2018. So it's relatively new. Unlike any other whiskey, Screwball Peanut Butter Whiskey actually tastes like peanut butter and can be enjoyed standalone, which we have verified, and as part of a cocktail, which we have also verified.
We've done a lot of verifying.
It works with a wide range of flavor profiles, which we will display for you today because our drink is fruity.
It's weird that it works.
It's weird that it works.
It's so weird.
But it works.
It does.
From sweet to savory, from strong to fruity and herbaceous, Screwball can really elevate a cocktail. Also, Screwball Peanut Butter Whiskey represents the black sheep, misfits, and screwballs of the group and reminds them that by being who they are indeed part of the community.
Oh, I love
which
that.
Which I love.
Love it.
That's kind of us.
Yes.
I'm kind of a screwball.
I am total screwball. And honestly, the story I'm telling is definitely screwed the fuck up.
Oh my gosh.
It's perfect.
Screwball is defined as an individual who is not afraid to break away from the crowd and be their own individual. Screwballs are not afraid to forge their own path and tend to thrive outside their comfort zones. Screwball Whiskey is available in all 50 states and recently expanded to Canada.
I love it.
So thank you to our friends at Screwball.
Thank
we
you.
We love your whiskey.
Yes, we do. We have partaken. And I do have to say, I'm not a huge whiskey fan, but I love this whiskey.
You do.
Yeah. So, I mean, even if you're not a whiskey drinker, give this a try. I bet you'll like it.
Delicious.
Yeah.
So our cocktail today for your Texas Murderer? Is he a murderer?
Maybe, maybe not.
Oh my gosh, we don't even know. Okay, so for this episode, because we are in Texas, the state fruit of Texas is grapefruit, ruby red grapefruit to be exact. So today we made a Screwball Paloma, which was one of Screwball's suggestions. So we started out with 2 ounces of Screwball peanut butter whiskey, 1.5 ounces of Blanco tequila, 1/2 ounce of Aperol, and 4 ounces of grapefruit juice. I did all that over ice, shook it, divided it between 2 highball glasses over ice, and then topped it off with soda water. And I garnished it with a peanut butter chocolate wafer stick.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Like a pirouette.
Yeah.
But peanut butter chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And it was delicious.
It was wild. Because I thought, this is not going to work. Grapefruit and peanut butter.
And everything is very well represented, like you said.
Yeah, you taste the peanut butter. You taste the grapefruit.
But it works.
Bizarre.
But I guess like orange and
orange and chocolate work. And orange and, well, yeah, I don't know.
I don't understand it, but it does work.
We don't care. And you know, we don't need to.
We
don't need to understand it. We just need to drink it.
It's very good.
And it was really, really good.
So thank you again to our friends at Screwball
thank
for
you.
Making that possible for us.
We are quite enjoying our drinks today. Obviously, I can't even freaking speak.
As you may have guessed by listening to a few episodes of the Killer Spirits podcast, we look up some pretty questionable information online. Without context, some of our interests could appear pretty suspicious. That's why we use Surfshark, the VPN service we trust.
With Surfshark, you can protect your online identity and keep you and your family's online activity private at all times. Surfshark can offer the assurance you need that you are browsing privately with encryption so no one can track or steal your data, including hackers, companies, or bots. Their strict no-logs policy ensures that even Surfshark can't track you. They don't keep any record of your online activity. You can change your IP address to hide your location to avoid tracking.
With the S-Alert feature, Surfshark gives real-time alerts when your emails and passwords are at risk of being hacked. And with their clean web feature, you can surf the web with no annoying ads, trackers, malware, or phishing attempts.
One of the most unique things about Surfshark is that you can protect your family on an unlimited amount of devices for a super low price, and they have 24/7 customer support. Follow the link in the description to support the show and sign up for Surfshark today at prices starting as low as $2.49 a month.
That is a seriously incredible deal for a little extra safety and security for you and your family.
Agreed. Go check them out in the link in the description. Okay, so our story today, honestly, I had a different story chosen.
Oh, really?
For Thanksgiving. For Halloween today.
Oh, that's right. You're going to do that house.
Yeah, I was going to do the Monroe house, which I think is still a very, you know, good story to do. I mean, it's in my back pocket, guys. I think okay. It might be good. But I pivoted hardcore for some reason. I just wasn't feeling that story.
Sometimes you're not.
Yeah. And so I started looking into this story and I fell down 300,000 rabbit holes.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, this is a story that starts one way and you do not expect it to end another way. It's the doggona, isn't it?
That's crazy.
Our next drink, guys, just listen for our next drink for the next episode. It's wild. Mm-hmm. So this murder happens in Amarillo, Texas in 1981. So we're going to go back in time a bit, okay? In Amarillo, Texas in 1981, there was a serial killer rapist who was targeting elderly women.
Hmm.
And women had been raped, strangled, and mutilated, and the community was pretty fearful at this point, especially for their elderly mothers and grandmothers living alone.
Poor ladies.
Yeah, there was somebody on the loose. On Halloween night 1981, Sister Tadea Benz from the St. Francis Convent was asleep in her bedroom. She was 76 years old, and every morning at the nunnery, they had mass at 6:30, and Sister Benz would always participate. I mean, she lived there. This was her life. On Sunday, November 1st, she didn't show up, so one of the other sisters went to her room and found her on the floor. Sister Tadea had been brutally beaten, raped, strangled, and mutilated.
God.
And just a few weeks earlier, another victim by the name of Narnie Bryson, who was 77 years old, was also murdered. And Narnie just lived a few blocks down the road from the convent. Sister Tadea's murder and Narnie's murder were strikingly similar. The killer gained entry through a cut screen and jagged glass of a window in the back of the convent. So basically broke the window, crawled in. Mm-hmm. Which is weird because I've seen pictures of the window and it... Let's just put it this way. You're not a huge person to be climbing through this window.
Oh, so it's pretty close to the ground.
No, I mean...
Oh, it's a small window.
It's not that the window's small. It's just the part of the glass that's broken doesn't look big enough to get through. It's like the whole glass wasn't broken. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. That's how this person got through there. The killer crept up the stairwell, down the hallway, past the bedrooms of other nuns, and into Sister Benz's room. Now, Sister Tadea was then beaten... She was raped, and she was stabbed to death. A soft, blunt object, possibly the attacker's fist, caused wounds to her head and face. Her throat was cut by the same instrument that made cuts on her neck. Extreme pressure applied to her throat, crushed numerous bones, and cut her supply of oxygen. The medical examiner would later testify that he believed that she was raped after her death. Semen was found, and vaginal fluids were taken, fingerprints... Black curly hairs and blood, possibly from the murderer, were also found. The killer also left behind a white t-shirt crumpled on the floor next to the bed. Interestingly, there was also a white t-shirt discarded at the Bryson murder in the same manner. So Claude Stevens, a veteran police homicide detective, was selected to be part of a 5-team multi-agency task force to solve both of these murders. And the police department in Amarillo was under a lot of pressure about these murders.
I bet.
This was big news at the time. A nun killed on Halloween night in a convent.
That's a little Satan-y.
It's a little Satan-y. It's
a little devil-y.
Right. And again, the fact that this was All Hallows Eve, this murder happened in church, basically, and it was a nun. There was a lot of speculation around the fact that this might be some sort of devil worship thing, just like you said.
Oh, God.
But this doesn't actually seem, like, this killing, when you really look at it, doesn't really seem ritualistic. Mm. It seems like a crime of opportunity, but that's not what people were thinking at the time. Yeah. There was a hysteria. There was an anger, like a lynch mobby kind of anger happening.
And what year is this again?
1981.
Oh, yeah. That's around that time.
Yes. So rewards for any information leading to the killer increased daily. And offering rewards, as we have seen in some of our other stories, does not always lead to the truth.
No.
Didn't we? Was that the Alma Kelmaner case that we were talking about where that just caused a big fat mess? And this was also causing a mess. So Police Chief Jerry Neal was appointed just a few months prior to these murders. And before his appointment, Amarillo PD had suffered intense criticism over some botched capital murder investigations.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah, which had led to appeals and new trials. So there was competition between law enforcement agencies. There was no sharing of information. It was kind of like a pissing contest between agencies at this point. Right.
That's helpful.
There was no collaboration at all.
Yeah, especially when there's, like, actual people being victimized. That's great.
Right, exactly. There was a history of basically shoddy police work. So, you know, there wasn't that great of work happening in the DA's office either. Mm. And there was a lot of animosity between the DA's office and the police. And, I mean, hello, if you've ever watched Law & Order, you know that you're supposed to be on the same team and work together.
Yeah, supposed to be.
Yeah. So newly appointed District Attorney Danny Hill of Potter County worked to build bridges between the Sheriff's Department and the Amarillo Police Department.
Oh, that's good.
He's like, okay, we're gonna do this.
Yeah, figure it out.
Department heads got together to resolve issues in order to work on these murders. They're like, we need to get our shit together, and we need to work on these murders because there's probably going to be more if we don't.
Yeah.
They hired a full-time medical examiner to perform autopsies and testify for the state, which they did not have. And they hired Dr. Ralph Erdman. So in October 1981, Dr. Ralph Erdman, his first assignment was Sister Tadea Benz. She was his first case. So DA Danny Hill's popularity grew exponentially when he promised the public that he would seek the death penalty swiftly and often.
Okay.
He spoke of the New Testament pretty much in every media interview, and people loved him. I mean, Amarillo is right in the middle of the Bible Belt, and Danny Hill was definitely, I would say, kind of like a good old boy.
Okay.
And, you know, from what I could see, if you know what I mean, you know, he was very well liked by the public. And this was also the beginning of the whole satanic panic era of the 80s and 90s, which probably did not help matters at all. I think it just kind of fit perfectly into that whole, the start of all of that. Mm-hmm. So the thought of the time at the time was that these murders went way beyond a random act. The public believed the killer was waging a war against God and the Catholic Church, like personally. The police were operating under the assumption that Bryson and Sister Benz were killed by the same person. They were saying, this is way too similar to not be the same person. And so both murders took place in the early hours. Both were raped, beaten, strangled, and mutilated in the same way. The killer entered both residences through cut screens. Black hairs were found on the bodies of both victims and, of course, the crumpled white shirt that we talked about. Right.
And they're, like, blocks away from each other.
And, yeah, exactly, and they're so close. So witnesses saw a darker-skinned man in the vicinity of the murders during the same time period, and they described him as possibly Cuban. On the night of Sister Benz's murder at about midnight, security guards stated they saw a dark-skinned man hiding behind a tree near the convent, and the man that they described actually fit other witness descriptions provided about a dark-skinned man lurking around Narnie Bryson's home on the night that she was murdered. Mm. But when guards approached the man by the convent, he ran away. And I'm not sure if these security guards were for the convent or for a nearby area, but this man was by the convent, they said.
Okay.
A few hours later, and this is, you know, Halloween night, at 2:30 a.m., Sister Pacifica Mugler took a call at the St. Francis Convent, which, I mean, sorry, that is a great name. But Tadea Benz is also a great name.
Yeah.
These nuns have great names. So she stated later it was a man with a thick Spanish accent that wanted to speak to a priest about his sexual desires. At 2:30 a.m.
in the morning?
Apparently so.
I mean, we're here to serve you, but come on.
Right. That's a little bit too much service. Yeah. Yeah. In a teletype message sent to police in Morgantown, West Virginia, Amarillo homicide detective stated that all of the physical evidence gathered at the scene of the Bryson and Benz murders suggested a Hispanic killer, possibly Cuban.
Okay.
But in 2008, Amarillo Police Chief Jerry Neal, then retired, actually denied this and said this was misinformation. There's a lot of this in the story.
Like, they're like, oh, I never said that.
That was actually never said. But, you know.
Who remembers everything they said 30 years ago?
Well, yeah, but still, you would think that this was a very high-profile case. You would remember what was said.
Yeah.
And in case you aren't really familiar with this time period, I mean, I was seven, so I was clueless. But in 1980, Cuban President Fidel Castro had opened the port of Mariel for immigration from Cuba.
Okay.
Causing a mass exodus. Approximately 125,000 Cuban asylum seekers came to the U.S. from April to October of 1980. That's a lot of people. Florida, in fact, was so inundated that at one point they declared a state of emergency, and many Cuban asylum seekers would end up all over the U.S., including Amarillo, Texas. Within days of Sister Benz's murder, D.A. Hill and Chief Neal would round up all of the Cubans who had immigrated from Miami and force them to verify their whereabouts on the nights of both murders. This doesn't seem like it would be legal. Okay.
Well, also, it would be very difficult to round up all the Cuban people.
I mean, Amarillo is not a big place.
I guess, yeah, that's probably what makes it, like,
yeah,
possible even.
Right. They were also forced to give hair and blood samples as well as fingerprints.
That doesn't seem
not seem legal. Yeah. So, again, the 80s was the Wild West. Yeah. I've said this before. So two of these men were Fernando Felipe Flores and Leoncio Perez Rueda. So both had been caught peeping in the windows of elderly women. That's not good. Mm-mm. They were both charged with trespassing. The DA and the chief were convinced that Flores was the murderer. So they found what they thought were blue fibers from Sister Benz's nightgown on Flores's clothing.
Okay.
So they send all of this stuff to the FBI to be tested. Okay. But on November 7th, the FBI cleared him. They said the fingerprints, the fiber, and the hair forwarded to them for processing from the Benz murder did not match him.
Hmm.
So now the DA and the chief are looking bad because they're like, well, we were so sure of this. So they pull out all of the stops. Another victim who had been in a coma from her injuries woke up with no memory of what happened to her. So they used hypnosis.
Of course.
That failed.
Yeah.
Then the psychic came forward. Her name was Inez Bubbles Patterson.
I like the name Inez.
Inez is great, but Bubbles, come on, Bubbles. So
that's the AKA.
That's the AKA.
So that's her psychic name.
Bubbles had apparently assisted the police on other murders. So they're like, oh, we know Bubbles. And she alleged that she had had a dream where she saw Sister Benz's killer and then proceeds to describe him. She said he was thin with a muscular frame, 5'11". She was very specific. What she described as an Abe Lincoln face and large ears. And apparently this dream also showed her the killer's address. 4000 Northeast 18th Street. And she gave them a name from this dream, Mr. Clyde. So Bubbles' husband, whose name was Michael Eugene Heavy Duty Patterson. Heavy Duty and Bubbles. Come on, guys.
This is who we're consulting?
And it, honestly, parts of the story, I'm like, is this even fucking true life?
Is this even real?
Is this even real? Unfortunately, this is very real.
No one denied this part.
No one's denying this. So, yeah, Heavy Duty was a narcotics trafficker, but he was not actually a very good one because he got caught.
Well, too bad he doesn't have a psychic for a wife.
Right. Wouldn't she have foreseen that? Exactly.
You'd think.
And there's not much information here about this, but I kind of wonder what Heavy Duty got or didn't get from police because of this quote unquote information that Bubbles provided.
Okay. So she was not under duress, but like,
I don't know.
Led.
I'm not sure, but I kind of wonder if maybe he got like a lesser sentence or, I mean, who knows? But because of her dream, a new suspect emerged really quickly, mm-hmm. like within a few days. And his name was Johnny Frank Garrett. Johnny was a 17-year-old who lived down the street from the convent. And of course, Johnny fit Bubbles' description perfectly. He lived at the exact address that she saw in her dream.
Of course.
And he had a dog named Mr. Clyde.
Oh, shut up.
I'm not kidding. And Mr. Clyde, the dog, had a nice doghouse in the backyard with his name clearly painted across the front of it. If you're fucking on the street, you could see it says Mr. Clyde. Okay, so.
So what if she just walked past the house one time?
Thank you.
Literally one time.
But nobody would have thought that.
Right.
Right? All other suspects or thoughts of any suspects, gone.
Oh, okay.
They are laser focused on this kid. So on the night of Sister Benz's murder, just before midnight, a policeman stated he saw Johnny standing outside his house beating a bush with a stick. Okay.
Okay.
This observation was offered up by police as their number one reason for suspecting his involvement in the murder of Sister Benz.
What?
Don't ever go beat any bushes with sticks, guys. You're going to be fucking set up for murder. They're going to arrest you.
He was framed. That is bizarre.
Isn't that bizarre? So he had a previous arrest for vandalism.
Okay.
And his fingerprints were on file.
Great.
His fingerprints were matched to two fingerprints in Sister Benz's room.
Oh.
So yeah, you're like, wow. Police allegedly found one fingerprint on the back of Sister Benz's headboard and the other one on a bent butter knife that was found on the floor under the bed.
You said allegedly.
Well, everything's allegedly.
Okay.
You know, I mean, they found two fingerprints. Okay. So Johnny Frank Garrett was born on December 24th, 1963. He grew up in a lower income area and he had learning difficulties. He was described as quote unquote slow. I forgot to talk about it in the beginning of the episode, but one of the major sources that I used for today, it is a documentary from 2008 and it's called The Last Word. So it's very difficult to find. I think you have to like order the tape of it. but there are some places online that you might be able to find it. I actually highly suggest it. It's very well done. It's definitely, and I feel like this with any documentary, there's always a lens that you're looking through.
Of course.
This one has a very specific lens, but it has some really good information. And it has a lot of interviews on there with people and people who knew Johnny. And they all said, and these are their words, that he was mentally retarded or slow.
Yeah.
They use slow a lot. Okay. So I personally wonder what the spectrum of that was, because the more you learn about Johnny, the more you realize he suffered horrific abuse in his youth. Mm. And when a child is suffering abuse, they don't really have the capacity to learn and flourish in school.
Right.
So by the end of sixth grade, he could actually not read or write. Mm. And again, I wonder how much was learning difficulties and how much was just the adults in his life severely and consistently failing him.
Right.
So as a child, he was repeatedly burned, beaten, and raped by two separate stepfathers.
Oh, God.
Yes. He was also sold to other men by his abusers. He would sleep under the football stands in a nearby stadium to escape the abuse.
I can't stand it.
No, it's actually horrific what this child went through. When Johnny was 14, he started using alcohol and drugs. Oh, what a surprise.
Yeah, no kidding.
He was in fights and was constantly suspended. And there's actually another interesting documentary, which is much easier to get a hold of. It's called Crazy, Not Insane. And I think it's on HBO Max or something like that. Anyway, it's about a psychiatrist named Dr. Dorothy Ottenow Lewis, who has researched multiple personality disorder her entire career, which is not called that anymore. I don't know if you knew this. It's called dissociative identity disorder.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So specifically, she was really interested in this disorder, specifically in murderers to try and understand why they kill. So in the 80s, she conducted a study on multiple underage offenders who were on death row. And Johnny Frank Garrett was one of them. She believed he had multiple personality disorder, though I did a lot of research. This was the only place I ever saw this. Nobody ever talked about this at all in any of the research that I looked at. They talked about the part that he might be mentally impaired, but I never saw anything about dissociative disorder or multiple personality disorder.
So they attributed it to a learning disability and not a mental illness, is what you're saying.
I honestly believe in the 80s, they didn't fully understand any mental illness at all. I mean, we still sometimes don't understand. But honestly, it wasn't even looked at or talked about. Mm. You know, it's just odd. It's very, very odd. She actually did an interview with him, and you can watch it in this documentary, which is very interesting. There's a lot of really interesting interviews in this documentary, which she did with a lot of different killers. He would speak about his dead Aunt Barbara. He would speak to his dead Aunt Barbara while he was in prison.
Okay.
Okay, so he would say that he saw people who had died.
Okay.
There's a video in the documentary of him speaking to her as another personality, which is interesting. Okay. And this personality he created in order to protect himself from the terrible abuse that he suffered. That
does happen.
And he also indicated in these videos that you can watch that he was also forced to participate in child pornography as a child with other boys as well as a dog. So it's very rough watching. I'm just letting you guys know. I know I told you it's a rough one. So it's an interesting documentary, and it delves really deep into kind of like her uphill battle with the psychiatric community, because a lot of people in the psychiatric community do not believe that this is a thing. They do not believe in multiple personality disorder. And I'm not a psychiatrist, so I have no clue, but go watch it, judge for yourself.
How do you not believe in it?
They really feel that it's an act. And it is interesting, if you're watching some of these killers talk to her, it doesn't seem real. You're like, he's fucking acting right now. But again, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I don't know.
And I also don't live with DID.
Exactly. I don't either. So, she believes this is a thing, and she believed that Johnny Frank Garrett had multiple personality disorder. Okay. So I'm not here to tell you one way or the other. I'm just saying that you should go watch it, because it's very interesting watching. So Johnny Frank Garrett was arrested and was interrogated, and his home was searched for evidence. And according to the police, after an hour of interrogation, Johnny confessed. But Johnny refused to sign the 8-line confession that they drafted for him. His Miranda rights were provided. He signed it. And this encounter was videotaped. We're reading you your Miranda rights. You're signing it. We're videotaping it. But somehow the video is not running during this quote-unquote confession.
Okay.
Isn't that odd? Mm-hmm. Johnny said he never confessed, and he never said what was drafted in this confession and did not sign it. Never signed it.
Okay.
Even though when you read a lot of things, it says, oh, he confessed. Well, no, he never signed it.
And it wasn't on tape, so.
And it wasn't on tape.
Who's to say?
So the confession read, my name is Johnny Frank Garrett. I'm 17 years old, and I live at 400 Northeast 18th in Amarillo with my mother. On October 31st, 1981, at approximately 1:30 a.m., I was drunk on whiskey and had taken two hits of acid. I heard that some nuns kept the nice stereos where they lived, and I went over to the convent and knocked a window out on the bottom floor. I went upstairs, and I went into this one room. There was a nun in bed, and she acted like she was going to scream. I covered her mouth so she couldn't make any noise. I started choking her until she passed out, and then I had sex with her. I left the convent the same way that I came in. That's the full confession. According to this confession, he says that he left the same way that he got in, through the broken window. But evidence from the crime scene established the killer left blood smears on the first floor fire exit door frame, and investigators found no glass on the ground beneath the broken window of the convent. So it was obviously broken from the inside. There was glass there, but there was no glass on the outside. And like I said earlier, this is not a big hole to crawl through. I feel like some glass would have been out there. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm just telling you what the evidence showed. It was clear that the killer did not leave the same way he came in. He most likely left through that exit door downstairs. 2 days after his arrest, he appeared in court for his arraignment. And Garrett told the judge he was innocent and he had never confessed. He also said he had been in the convent dozens of times prior to the murder, and there could be hundreds of fingerprints there that could belong to him.
Oh, they failed to mention that.
They're going to fail to mention a lot of things.
Yeah.
So Bishop Leroy Matheson presided over the diocese at the time of the murder and would later say that the other nuns told him that they all knew Johnny Frank Garrett very well and that he would come there and visit them. He had helped them move furniture out of the convent into a moving truck on one occasion. Some of the nuns had been moving to start up another community, and he had assisted with that move. Mm-hmm. He had entered the nuns' bedrooms with their permission and assisted in moving furniture and other items. So he very well could have left fingerprints.
Yeah.
Garrett's mother and his two sisters said he was home all night on Halloween night playing checkers. At this point, it doesn't appear that he had been even provided an attorney. Like, at his arraignment, it was very odd. And, like, some random lawyer named Bill Coleus, who had never tried a murder case, just showed up to Johnny's arraignment and asked the judge if he could be assigned to the case. I don't know if it happens, if it's supposed to happen like
I
that.
I don't think so.
But in the 80s, it was very different. Public defending was very different back then. Hmm. So, you know,
just like less regulated, or
yeah, and I think it was very difficult for public defenders because they basically made zero money,
right?
So there just wasn't a lot of them.
So it was just like people taking pro bono cases that were probably actual, or they were just people who couldn't get jobs anywhere else.
I think that's ding ding. I think
and they're
that's
like,
it.
I need something on my record.
I think
to
that's
show
it.
That I can be a lawyer. So can I get this guy?
Right, and that's basically what happened. And the judge was like, okay.
Sure.
And can we just not forget that Johnny was 17? He's not an adult yet. He's right. Basically a child. And if he is quote unquote slow, like people say, he's not savvy with the system. I mean, even the average adult cannot navigate the justice system.
Yeah.
The average very smart adult. So he wouldn't know that he could refuse and ask for another lawyer. He wouldn't know this. He wouldn't know that this lawyer also was not going to provide him a good defense at all. Substandard might actually be too nice of a word for the defense that he will end up being provided.
That's annoying.
It's terrible. So by law, he would get two lawyers, and the judge did appoint a second one by the name of Phil Jordan, but he had also never tried a murder case.
Phil.
And interestingly, just months prior to this, he and... Oh, no, I'm sorry. A few months prior to this, Phil Jordan had actually worked as a prosecutor with his best friend from childhood, D.A. Danny Hill.
Okay, bye.
I mean, that just seems weird.
The conflict is
yeah,
obvious.
And also months would go by and his attorneys wouldn't even speak with him. He was just in prison after his arraignment and they didn't even speak with him. What? Didn't try to like talk with him, hear his side of the story. Didn't try to bolster his case, nothing. So blood splatters and smears found outside Sister Tadea's room were thought to be from the killer who could have possibly been injured in the attack. Semen and blood samples were provided to the medical examiner, Dr. Erdman, for testing. Now, DNA was not available in 1981, but the semen samples could be tested to determine the killer's blood type. Okay. So within days of receiving these samples, they inexplicably disappeared. Dr. Erdman thought the samples had been accidentally thrown away.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's what we do. We just throw away stuff in evidence bags.
I'm sorry, sir. What? Yeah. And normally, samples like this were sent to a State Department of Public Safety lab or even the FBI lab, which we saw some of the other stuff was sent to, especially high-profile cases. Mm-hmm. Not the medical examiner. So why this time were they sent to Dr. Erdman? I mean, I'm just stating the fact that it's pretty convenient they disappeared for the prosecution.
Is Dr. Erdman's daughter married to some DA guy or something?
Right. I don't know. So the FBI did complete testing on the other items from the crime scene. So some obviously were sent. And from Johnny's home. And their findings determined that Johnny's clothes had no blood on them. No pet hairs or fiber from Johnny's home matched samples collected at the crime scene. None of his shoes matched footprints found at the crime scene, and none of the shoes tested had glass embedded in the soles. None of the knives in his house matched the stab wounds. None of the foreign black hairs found in Sister Tadea's mouth and body matched Johnny's hair. And if you look at pictures of him, he's basically a sandy blonde white kid.
He's definitely not Cuban.
He is not Cuban. There were also fingerprints found that did not match Johnny's or anyone else at the convent and were found in her room. The butter knife found under her bed with his fingerprint on it had no blood on it and was not the murder weapon. He told his lawyers he had been in the convent many times, but they never checked his story. They didn't hire an investigator. In fact, they never even spoke to the other nuns. His lawyers 100% sucked.
They did nothing.
And these facts, like reasonable doubt facts, were not brought up in trial. No one from the convent was ever asked to testify on his behalf or testify at all for any reason. Even the bishop expressed surprise that no one reached out to them.
Yeah, no kidding. Like, hello, we were all there.
Yeah. So Johnny's lawyers did file a motion to change the venue, but the judge denied it. And if ever there was a case that needed a change of venue, it was fucking this one, okay, no guys? Kidding. It was all over the papers and the news. And if anyone was around in the 80s, you will remember we didn't have the onslaught of media like we do now. It was very different. It's not like you could, you know, look at the internet, you could do this. So, I mean, you had like your 11 a.m. news, your 6 p.m. news, and your 11 p.m. news. And like everyone was riveted to that. And that's what they saw, and that's all the information they got. They weren't getting it from all these other places. So what you saw on the news is what you believed.
And sort of the part that I don't really, like, understand is, don't these lawyers care about their record at all?
Not if it's going to be political, maybe. I don't know. But I agree with you.
Because it's like your client's going to lose.
I know.
That doesn't look good on your record, like, that you're a losing lawyer only.
Well, this was a sensational case, and it would have been practically impossible to draw an impartial jury from Amarillo.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether you believe that he's guilty or not. And then this decision by the judge was most likely political to bolster his reelection campaign, and he most likely got pressure from DA Danny Hill.
Of course.
And I think this was also the nail in the coffin for Johnny. I mean, he was already in the coffin, but this was just the nail that shut it. And Danny Hill, DA Danny Hill, was definitely an expert at media manipulation. And I think it was a much easier to be a media manipulator back then because you pretty much only had a few media streams to be manipulating. So Johnny Garrett's guilt was fully spun in the media, and he certainly was not innocent until proven guilty. He was guilty, and he was considered guilty until proven innocent.
Right.
And we're definitely not going to make it easy on you to prove yourself innocent.
Well, and also,
you shouldn't have to do.
Yeah, if he did have developmental disabilities, nothing is easy for him.
Right.
It's not going to be easy for him anyway, even if he had the best lawyers in the world.
I know. So it took 31 days to appoint a jury, which doesn't seem, I mean, I was on that death penalty case and it literally took like 45 days.
Yeah.
Also, I never knew in Texas, they do not call it voir dire. Mm-hmm. They call it voir dire.
Okay.
I mean, that's just what they call it.
The voir dire.
It's the voir dire. Okay. So his lawyers failed him hardcore with this jury selection.
None of those French words.
So a business, and guys, I was born in Texas, so I am a Texan. Relax. We're not making fun of you. I love Texas. Okay?
I lived in Texas too, and I am making fun of you. Oh. No, I'm joking.
No, we're not. But we could probably find something about every state to make fun of.
That's
me.
True.
So a business associate of Dr. Erdman, our sample losing medical examiner, was selected for the jury. Nathan Shackelford, the nephew of the state's first listed punishment witness, Family Court Judge Jerry Shackelford was also selected for the jury.
Wait, what'd you call him? First listed?
Yeah, I'll explain what okay. he is. Yeah. So if Johnny was found guilty, in an effort to secure the death penalty, it would fall to Judge Shackelford to testify that Johnny had a bad character and a propensity for violence. So that's kind of his job in this whole thing. Okay. And there, he's basically called the first listed punishment witness. Okay. So there could be other punishment witnesses, but he's one of them. Well, his nephew is put on the jury.
Okay.
What the
fuck? There's not enough people in this town, clearly.
That's, yeah, exactly. And this is not to say that his nephew's a bad person, but it's another conflict of freaking interest, mm-hmm. you know? The state's case lasted 5 days. The only physical evidence linking Johnny Garrett to the crime were those fingerprints. That's it. Johnny's lawyer's only defense was his alibi based on what Johnny said and what his mother and sister said. That was their defense. Here's his alibi. They had a treasure trove of reasonable doubt that they could have brought up. Mm-hmm. They never did. They called no experts. They never shared with the jury that there had been other suspects in this case. They never shared that the hair from the crime scene did not match Johnny's. On and on and on and on and on. None of it was presented to the jurors. Whether you believe Johnny Frank Garrett was guilty or innocent, he still was not provided a fair trial.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen lots of guilty people, and yes, they're found guilty, rightfully so, but at least they were given a fair trial, mm-hmm. which is kind of what our whole United States is based on, you know? So the jury deliberated for 5 hours and found him guilty. As the guilty verdict was being read, Johnny Garrett stood up and screamed, "I'm innocent. I didn't kill her." After an hour after the verdict, Judge Shackelford, our first line witness, he was called, and one of Johnny's teachers, Carol Moore, was also called, and they both testified he was a danger to society and had a propensity for violence.
Did they ever put him on the stand?
I don't believe they did.
So they didn't even let him talk for himself.
Which they don't actually let a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
So that's, but, I mean,
if you're not
going to
put anybody up there.
Right? Like, did you not even call anybody? So in the documentary, The Last Word, attorney Jeff Blackburn, who is the director of the Innocence Project, told a story about how DA Danny Hill and a bunch of other people from the DA's office sat in the courtroom with plastic syringes, laughing and squeezing the syringes during this sentencing for death. Like giggling like schoolgirls, he said.
I hate it.
Like literally having the time of their lives while a man is being sentenced to die. And again, whether you believe in the death penalty, whether you believe that, you know, he was guilty or not, that's still not the behavior that you would be doing. It's still a person who's going to die.
And it's still your profession.
And it's still
your... This isn't your free time.
It's so unprofessional. And also disrespectful to his family who are sitting there mm-hmm. in the courtroom. A news reporter by the name of Kathy Jones followed Johnny's mother to the bathroom and stuck the camera over the stall to get a photograph. Ew. That's a new low, dude.
Yeah.
The jury deliberated less than an hour. Death by lethal injection. Johnny was granted an automatic appeal with another lawyer. Mm-hmm. The judge appointed another lawyer with no past criminal murder experience by the name of Bruce Sadler. Johnny wrote him letter after letter, and he did nothing for 3 years. 3 years. Then he withdrew as Johnny's attorney and went to work for Danny Hill in the DA's office. 3 years wasted. Johnny was then passed from lawyer to lawyer, all of which failed him. Not one of his lawyers attempted to identify new evidence or even call into question the shitty defense that he had on the first trial. Mm-hmm. Johnny's final execution date was set for February 12th, 1992 at 6 p.m. So the Catholic Church had made it very clear that they did not support the execution of Johnny Frank Garrett, whether he was guilty or not guilty.
So I was going to ask that. What's the Catholic Church's stance then on lethal injection or capital punishment?
I can't tell you their full stance. Oh, I would say that they probably disagree with it, but I know in this case, they definitely disagreed with
it. Gotcha.
In fact, every bishop in Texas pleaded for a reprieve from the death penalty. And finally, Pope John Paul II intervened and reached out to Governor Ann Richards.
Oh, yeah. If the Pope's reaching out, then that's their official stance.
That's their official stance, yeah. So the governor said she did not have the authority to grant a commutation, but called together.
I don't think that's true. The governor?
Yeah.
That's not true.
Exactly.
She can grant anything. She can grant a stay of execution for indefinitely.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
That's why this is so frustrating. So anyway, she said she could not, but she called together the parole board and in the interim granted Johnny a 30-day reprieve. And this was the first time since Texas had resumed executions in 1982 that a governor had intervened. The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles had 18 members. In the plea for clemency, they heard testimony from Dr. Dorothy Lewis,
okay,
that I talked about, crazy, not insane.
Right.
They heard about his mental illness due to physical and sexual abuse. They heard about his IQ, which was, I believe, below 70.
Oh, all the shit that should have been brought up in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's cool. 17 voted against the commutation and one abstained. They all basically said, we don't agree, kill him.
What?
Yeah. After all of this testimony, they were not swayed at all. In fact, they even saw video of him speaking with Dr. Lewis, heard about the horrific abuse that he had suffered, all of it, and decided that they were going to uphold the execution. The governor did, as you said, did have the power to commute his sentence 100%. Instead, she deferred to the board and let them decide. Most likely because commuting his sentence would not look good for her career. And I mean, I've read a lot of things about Ann Richards. It sounds like she was a really good governor. But in this case, she failed. Public opinion was for death for Johnny Frank Garrett, and commutations are extraordinarily rare in Texas. So nothing's changed. Since Texas reinstated the death penalty in 1982, governors have issued discretionary commutations just 3 times, according to an American Bar Association report in 2019. 3 times between 1982 and 2019.
So the crimes were committed in 1981, mm-hmm, and they didn't go to trial until the death penalty wasn't reenacted until 1982.
Yes, but that was probably when he was
on trial.
Yeah.
That's annoying.
That's really annoying. And then he would be executed in 1992.
Right.
So in that time between 1982 and 2019, 566 people have been put to death in Texas.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. And also the death penalty in Texas, I mean, and this is not just Texas. This is many, many states, but it's very political.
Yeah, I
extremely
bet.
Political. So on February 11th, 1992, Johnny was transported from Texas Death Row in Huntsville to the Walls unit a few miles away. He would have his last visit with his family there. His attorneys filed one last appeal with the Supreme Court. The appeal was twofold. What they called his mental retardation, that's their words, not mine, mm-hmm, an IQ score below 70, and the fact that he was only 17 at the time of the crime. It was rejected an hour before his execution.
Wow.
None of those things mattered. At 5:55, the warden entered the death chamber and began to read the sentence to Johnny Frank Garrett as he lay strapped to the gurney with an intravenous line in his arm. The warden asked Johnny if he had anything to say, and he said, I'd like to thank my friends and family, and I'd like to thank my guru and everyone else who has helped me through this. And to the rest of the world, you can kiss my ever-loving ass, because I am innocent. And for those people responsible for my murder tonight, you know who you are. I could not turn my page. I have some words for you too. But I put those in a letter, something for you to look forward to tomorrow. Those were his last words. Mm-hmm. A huge crowd had gathered outside chanting, kill the freak, remember the nun. Because, you know, fucking people in executions.
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter if they're private. People still find a way.
Bajiggity.
In 1992, the murder of Narnie Bryson was still unsolved. So at the time of his execution, Narnie Bryson's murder was still unsolved.
Okay.
10 years after Johnny's execution, the Supreme Court reversed its position and outlawed execution of the quote-unquote mentally retarded. 3 years later, they halted executions of those who were under 18 at the time of their crimes. So both of those things would have basically removed him from the death penalty.
So today's standards would not have killed him.
Correct.
Yeah.
23 years after the murder of Narnie Bryson and sister Tadea Benz, new evidence came after a detective reopened the Narnie Bryson cold case. He submitted DNA to the FBI, and the semen recovered from Narnie Bryson's body matched the DNA of a man incarcerated in New Mexico. And you'll never believe it, this was also a man who had been in custody in Amarillo as a suspect in Sister Tadea's murder, whose head, hair, and pubic hair matched the hairs found at the scene of the Bryson and Benz murders, and who had been caught peeping in the windows of elderly women. Leoncio Perez Rueda.
God damn it.
Before his arrival to the U.S. in 1980, he had been convicted of rape and murder in Cuba. He was arrested and promptly blamed the murder of Narnie Bryson on his friend, the other guy they'd had in custody, Fernando Flores. But they had sent stuff for that one. Remember they, well, they, I
yeah,
don't
but
know.
They didn't send it for the other one.
You're right. But they still,
or they did and they lost it.
Who the fuck knows? So when asked about the sister Tadea Benz murder, he also blamed that on Fernando Flores.
But they know it wasn't him.
He said Flores told him he had beaten a nun, and he also said that he had been at the nunnery and was provided clothing by the nuns. So, yes, Rueda definitely is guilty, and he's trying to blame it on someone else.
Mm-hmm.
In 2004, Leoncio Perez Rueda was linked by DNA to Narnie Bryson's murder. He confessed, but then, lucky him, he was able to cut a deal. He's currently serving 45 years for her murder with the chance of parole and no further charges. That was his deal.
Why? What did he give up?
Why? And also why? Like, I mean, I know this is years later, but like Johnny was never given any deal for anything.
Nope.
Evidence collected at the scene of Sister Benz's murder and from Johnny Garrett were still being stored at the Amarillo PD in 2008. Johnny's mother requested DNA testing to clear his name and stated she would agree never to sue the state for wrongful execution if they would test these items. It was refused, and the state actually turned the tables on her and threatened to sue her.
What?
And most likely this evidence will be destroyed or has already been destroyed.
Does the state sue people?
They can. They can sue you for suing us for wrongful death.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so who knows? And then this was, and again, that was 2008. So who knows where that evidence is now? It could be destroyed.
That's
I don't
sad.
Know. Yeah. So parts of the letter from Johnny Frank Garrett that he talked about in his execution stated, I have been charged, convicted, sentenced, and punished for rape and murder. If given the chance, I could have proven not only beyond a reasonable doubt, but beyond any doubt, my innocence. You, society, did not give me a chance to do so. I'm resigned to death. All people die. I'm going to die with a clear conscience, a whole spirit and a man, an honorable warrior's death. But you, society, will live in shame in your nightmares. I will live. Every death of your families will be me. I will be the one who meets your family's souls, and they will pay for what you, society, has done to my family. I will be the fear you will experience upon your last breath. I curse your souls to the deepest depths of your own hell. I curse your parents' soul to the same hell, and your grandparents' souls and your ancestors clean back to the damnable dog that began your line. I curse every person remotely related to your infected blood. And because I know the curses will be fulfilled, I meet death in a better spirit and a stronger soul.
Damn, dude.
That was, yeah.
That I like was the infected letter. Blood part.
I know. So he's pissed.
Yeah.
Now, people have said this is why this documentary was called His Last Word, because that was his last word. Yeah. And they're saying, based on some of the events that happened after his execution, he got the last word. Mm. Okay. So I'm going to read you some of the things that happened now that you've heard this letter.
About, ooh, were these people really cursed?
Well, I shall read you and you be the judge.
Wow.
So in 1992, Ralph Erdman was forced to surrender his Texas medical license to the State Board of Medical Examiners. He was indicted for falsifying autopsy reports and committing perjury in dozens of civil and criminal cases.
There you go.
He was crooked as fuck.
Yeah.
He was convicted and sentenced to prison. He also pleaded guilty to charging several counties for autopsies he had never conducted.
Fun.
On July 23rd, 2010, in Dallas, Texas, Dr. Erdman died at the age of 83, but before this, his wife would pass away from pancreatic cancer. Attorney Bill Coleus, you know, his rando, died of pancreatic cancer.
That's interesting.
Kathy Jones, the NBC News reporter who chased Johnny's mother into the bathroom, died instantly in a plane crash in 1994.
Okay.
The judge who set Johnny's final execution date, Judge Kaiser, and the assistant district attorney, who was his lawyer that talked to him for 3 years, Bruce Adler, they were both diagnosed with the same rare form of leukemia.
What the fuck?
They would both end up in remission. Judge Kaiser's doctors would actually extract his healthy bone marrow in case of recurrence, which they do. The leukemia did come back, and his healthy bone marrow inexplicably disappeared from the hospital lab.
Hmm.
He died within months. Two task force members also contracted leukemia and passed away. A juror who convicted Johnny to death fell down the stairs at her home and died a week later from her injuries. Juror Nathan Shackelford's daughter died from an accidental gunshot wound to the head. And his sister was killed in a hit-and-run drunk driver incident.
This is bizarre.
Michael Heavy Duty Patterson, you know, Bubbles Hubby.
Heavy dude.
He was found dead, slumped over the steering wheel in his driveway, and the cause of his death was never determined.
I could.
Right.
Venture
some of these.
Guess.
We could venture a guess on all of these. You just don't know, right?
I mean, his name was Heavy Duty.
Right. So Lonnie Watley, a jailhouse snitch who had, for a reduced sentence, testified at trial that Johnny Frank Garrett admitted to killing Sister Benz, committed suicide. I don't believe Johnny ever said that to this person. Carol Moore, Johnny's teacher who testified against him, also committed suicide.
Wow.
DA Danny Hill became addicted to alcohol and prescription pills. After two DUIs, fellow prosecutors testified against him in an effort to remove him from office. On April 9th, 1995, Hill ended his life with a single gunshot wound to the heart. Sadly, his youngest daughter hung herself a few years later.
Wow.
That's a lot.
The despair that followed his execution was intense.
Right. So, I mean, curses, no curses. Apparently, there's actually a horror film called Johnny Frank Garrett's Last Word, which is based on this. I have not watched it. I'm not a huge horror fan person, but I kind of want to watch it now.
Just now that you know the backstory.
Now that I know the backstory. But yeah, so it is very interesting. And again, that I really tried to state the facts. And you can be the judge on if you think that, an innocent man was put to death or not. Based on what I see, it feels to me like an innocent man was put to death.
Yeah.
And if that is the truth, I mean, Johnny Frank Garrett was just basically failed from the day of his birth. And it's a very, very sad case.
Yeah.
So that's the murder of Sister Tadea Benz and the tragic story of Johnny Frank Garrett.
That was a good one. That was very interesting.
Thank you.
I didn't know. I mean, we never really talk about we talk about capital punishment, but not to that extent.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that they were just executing people with developmental disabilities for.
Yeah. Or basically someone who's underage also. I mean,
or a 17-year-old, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when he's executed, he wasn't. But when he committed the crime, or if he committed the crime.
I think that's when it starts, isn't it?
17.
Aren't you tried on the age you are when the incident is committed?
Yes. So, anyway. And regardless of how you feel about capital punishment, you know, I think it is important to really look at all stories, and, you know, there will always be incidences where an innocent person could die. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was interesting because in the documentary, the lawyer, the one who was in charge of the Innocence Project, said that, you know, when he went to school to be a lawyer, he'd always heard, you know, it was like the old saying, like, you know, I'd rather, you know, let 100 guilty people go free than to convict one innocent person. And he said that thought process is not really the same anymore.
It doesn't ring true to everybody.
It doesn't ring true to everyone. It said, oh, well, you know, there's just going to be some people who are, you know, it's worth the risk of having an innocent person. And I mean, I kind of agree with him. It's not worth the risk because that innocent person could be you. That innocent person could be someone that you love, mm-hmm. you know? And so, I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's an interesting thought provoking thing. To really think about our society and how far we've come or not come from 1981 to 2021.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I know that, I mean, the hard part about it is that it can't really be fixed.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, there are things like the Innocence Project that can be done to right those wrongs after they've already been done. But, I mean, that's kind of just how it goes.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, but I don't think it'll ever, that's never going to go away.
I know, unfortunately. But, I mean, it helps to be knowledgeable. It
helps, you know, to be aware.
As much, and I'd never heard that story, and I kind of feel like as time goes by, people forget things. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons we love to do this show, because we'll never let you forget.
Right. And I also think stories like this are a good testament to, like, you know, when people say, like, you know, they roll their eyes at people saying that they're innocent. Like, oh, there's no, why would you be in jail if you're innocent? And it's like, well, you don't always know.
You don't always know.
So, you know, we'll be judged by something else.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and that's kind of what Johnny said.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he said.
And
you know?
Don't, if you are a law enforcement person or a person who does medical examinations or whatever, don't fuck it up because you might get cursed.
Yeah. You may get cursed.
And, you know, things might end badly for you.
Right.
Oh, what an interesting, like, karma story.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. You want to tell them where to find us?
Oh, if you would like to reach out and say hello, offer up some ideas for a story, which we love, offer up cocktail ideas, whatever you'd like, you can email us at killerspiritspod@gmail.com. You can always find us on Instagram at Killer Spirits Pod. We'll post pictures from the episode today and also pictures of our cocktail. We're on TikTok, Killer Spirits Pod. If you'd like any Killer Spirits Pod merchandise, we have an Etsy shop. It's just called Killer Spirits Pod. We have some really fun stuff over there. Coffee cups, t-shirts, aprons, all the good shit.
Oh, yeah.
Go check it out.
Go rate and review. We love you guys.
Bye. Bye.